Start by telling you why I got interested in Poincaré Lipschitz gravity. And I got interested in this as a utilitarian, because I'm a cosmologist, and I saw something in Poincaré Lipschitz gravity that I could use for cosmology. In particular, I could use it to make some people on the West Coast, in particular at Stanford, very unhappy, which is to propose an alternative to inflation. Okay, and this is where bouncing universe comes in. Okay, so now having done a little bit of work, I realized that there are some very deep potential problems with Poincaré-Lipschitz gravity, problems which you heard about in the two previous talks. Now, I'll not be addressing these problems. I will have just something minimal to say about it, but this will be here. But still, maybe this minimal thing that I have to say might still be relevant eventually. So these are two of the references, and some other references will come. Okay. So the introduction is going to be very brief. In fact, I just want to remind you of the framework we are talking about. And so I've prepared this here. This is to set notation. So we're talking about this very conservative approach to quantum gravity, where all we deal with is the four-dimensional metric variables, the three-dimensional metric, the laps and the shift. But it's very radical. It's a very radical approach because you break Lorentz invariants. So time and space are treated differently. So this is the action, the kinetic part of the action, which involves time derivatives. This is the part of the action that doesn't involve time derivatives. The two key parameters that I want to draw your attention to is this lambda in the kinetic term. In general relativity, lambda is equal to 1. There's a symmetry that forces lambda equals to 1, a symmetry which you lose if you give up one of the symmetries that I'll mention. And then the key point that makes Poincaré-Lipschitz gravity into a potentially better UV theory of gravity is the fact that you add higher spatial derivative terms, and mu is a coefficient of one of these terms. Now, this is the form of the action assuming detailed balance. I don't think detailed balance is going to be relevant at all to what I'm going to talk about. So view this as a simplified expression. Now, what is going to be relevant, especially for part three of the talk, is the fact that I'm working in terms of the non-projectable version. So my n is a function of space and time. And most of what I say about cosmological perturbations is going to depend on that. OK, so this is.
To the fourth, is that just a coupling?
Yeah, W is just a coupling. OK. Good. OK, so this was the model. So let's try to do cosmology. So we are looking for, and let's try to do background cosmology. We're looking for homogeneous and isotropic solutions, but not spatially flat. So now it's going to be important that I look for spatially curved solutions. So I write down the metric, ES squared, as minus dT squared plus dIJR dxi, dxj. And for the spatial part of the metric, I write down a scale factor, and then a metric for either the sphere or the hypersphere. OK, and now to take my color chart. Here, there's the k-bar, the spatial curvature parameter, which will play a crucial role. Okay. So now if you plug in this ansatz for the metric into this action, then you get cosmological equations, the analogs of the Friedmann-Robertson-Walker-Lemet equation. And they read the following, 6 times d lambda minus 1 over kappa squared So kappa is related to Newton's constant. Don't confuse it with k bar. H squared is equal to rho. That's what it would be in Friedmann. But now there's an extra term. And this extra term comes from geometry. And this is 3 kappa squared mu squared. So you see that it comes from the higher derivative terms, times divided by 8, 3 lambda minus 1. Look at this minus sign. It's relevant. Then there's k bar over a squared minus lambda squared. And I will take the cosmological constant to be very small. So in the early universe, where the scale factor is small, it is this term that dominates. So this is the first of the two equations. And the second equation is 2 times 3 lambda minus 1, acceleration equation, h dot is equal to minus 1 plus w over 2 rho, where here the w is pressure divided by energy density of matter. It has nothing to do with this w here. Let me put a tilde on here. Okay, and then there's a next. So this is the way that the acceleration equation would be in the absence of higher derivative terms. And then there's the new term, which is kappa squared, mu squared, and divided by 4 times 3 lambda minus 1. And then k bar over a squared minus lambda k bar over a squared. Okay, so these are the Friedmann equations. And this is what caught my interest. Because take the cosmological constant to be small, because we are interested in the early universe, where this term dominates. Then you see that this term here is acting like something that decays as a to the fourth, and that's radiation. So this looks like dark. Dark, because it doesn't come from matter. It doesn't emit light. Ghost, because it has a negative sign. Radiation. Okay. So now this is wonderful, because if you start with ordinary non-relativistic matter,
some kind of assumptions about the rules on how the geometry couples to this matter?
It comes simply from this. Nothing mysterious. You've got this answer.
Where's the matter?
Yes. Okay, that's right. So my total action is so S total is SK plus SV plus S matter. And this S matter has an equation of state, which is P over rho. So you can take, for example, hydrodynamical mass for now.
So
later I will take scalar field matter, just to simplify the algebra.
But my scalar field, that would have been like a covariant action that I would have written down.
Mm-hmm. You can ask me that data. We can include higher derivative terms there as well. At this level, it's just hydrodynamical matter.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that not homogeneous then? She doesn't care anyway about the spatial derivatives. Don't care anything.
So Robert, this is in particular independent of whether or not we consider the projectable or
yes.
Not
predictable. That's not because I'm just look at the background. So everything I say at the background level is independent of this projectability. Mm-hmm. When I talk about perturbations, it becomes crucial. Okay. So back here, let's start with non-relativistic matter. So rho decays as 1 over a cubed. So see, if we start out with this term very small in a contracting universe, this term will become more and more dominant. And eventually, we'll catch up in absolute value to this term. And at that point, you have h equals 0 at a finite value, the scale factor. Then you can put in the solution here, and you find that h dot is positive. So what you have is a non-singular bounce. So you have a point in time with finite scale factor where h is equal to 0 and h dot is greater than 0. OK, so now I can maybe object and say, well, we know that regular matter contains radiation as well, the microwave radiation. So if you stick to the detailed balance form, you find that this bounce depends, first of all, on the presence of spatial curvature. And secondly, it depends on having almost no relativistic matter. But if you now include terms which deviate from detailed balance, then there are terms which go as 1 over a to the 6th. And then you can get a non-singular bounce also with radiation. See, lambda's only put, I want the model to be to give the correct late time limit, so that means that lambda has to be fine-tuned to be very, very small. And so therefore, it's totally unimportant in the early universe. As a cosmological constitution.
No, small lambda.
That's small lambda.
Can be anything, right, for this conclusion?
Because if
no,
it has, if this also holds,
I take lambda to be,
greater
to
than
be close to 1. Obviously, I have to be away from lambda equals 1/3. Everything
right,
goes.
Right. But this conclusion depends just on the positivity of that coefficient.
That's right. So I'm taking lambda to be greater than 1/3.
Okay.
One thing which is probably not apparent from the equations of motion is that if one looks for a bouncing solution in vacuum, which is without matter, you can get a bounce, but without detailed balance. If you have a detailed balance, then you have no bouncing vacuum.
Okay. But for whatever all of them talking about here contains matter. Matter plays a crucial role, in particular in the third part of the talk. You'll see that matter is absolutely crucial. In the presence of matter regulates some bad things, bad behavior.
Robert, is it sufficient to break detailed balance softly by relevant terms, or do you need to touch also the highest derivative terms?
The highest derivative terms. If you want to get the 1 over a6, I think. I'm not 100%.
You told that without detailed balance, the covered term is 1 over a6. But I think that
the. No, without.
But with z equals 3, the radiation also scales like 1 over A6.
If you mean you have radiation?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because of defining this partial radiation.
Okay.
Omega scales like, 1 over A cubed. So number density of photon scales like 1 over A cubed.
You're now taking in the photon, in the photon dispersion relations, you're also taking higher.
That's right.
Yes. Okay, so what you're saying is that this bounce may still require tuning the energy density of radiation to be very low.
But if z is larger than 3, okay, then the higher coverage terms dominates over radiation.
Okay.
So you can have a bounce.
Good. Okay, so this is part A of the second part, the fact that there is a possibility of getting a non-singular bounce. OK, so what I want to do now is I want to compare the space-time diagram of this non-singular bounce to what one has in inflationary cosmology. Okay. So this space-time diagram refers to inflation. This space-time diagram refers to a non-singular bounce. Okay. So now the first length scale that I want to plot is the Hubble radius. Hubble radius LH, which is defined as H inverse, H is usual expansion rate. That scale is relevant because if you look at fluctuations with wavelength larger than the Hubble radius, gravity dominates. Gravity is unimportant on scales smaller than H inverse. So if you want to create perturbations, you have to create perturbations on scales smaller than the Hubble radius. Okay, so now what does the Hubble radius do in inflation? So in inflation, we are talking about this period in which the scale factor increases exponentially. So in that case, during inflation, the Hubble radius is constant. Whereas after inflation, the Hubble radius is increasing linearly. Okay. Now, in a non-singular bounce in cosmology, where we have a scale factor as a function of time, which behaves like this, then H is zero here, H inverse is infinity. This is like in standard cosmology, this is the time reverse of standard cosmology. Hubble radius increases linearly here, Hubble radius decreases linearly here, and here the Hubble radius is infinite because H is zero. So what happens to the Hubble radius? It decreases linearly, like in inflation. At the bounce point, it is infinity. So now I want to plot the physical wavelength of something that we observe today. We look at fluctuations on a fixed co-moving scale, I call that K, and the physical wavelength, it increases like the scale factor. So I take this scale back to here. Okay, now let's set the scale of this problem. So if we are interested in fluctuations which we observe in the microwave background today, cosmological scales, and if I assume that the energy scale of inflation and the energy scale of the bounce is about 10 to the 15 GeV, then the physical wavelength here is about 1 millimeter. That's a physical wavelength at a temperature of about 10 to the 15 GeV, which corresponds to, which evolves into our current Hubble radius. This is the same thing here, 1 millimeter. Okay, so now in inflation, universe expands exponentially, so the physical wavelength that develops into 1 millimeter at the end of inflation is e to the minus n times 1 millimeter at the beginning of inflation, where n is the number of e foldings. Okay, so now there's a slight problem for inflation. Because if we take any inflationary model which is a little bit long, in which inflation lasts a little bit longer than the minimal amount it has to for inflation to be successful, then we find that the physical wavelength of fluctuations at the beginning of inflation is much smaller than the Planck length. And whenever we do theory of cosmological perturbations, we are basically using low energy physics to evolve perturbations, and that's clearly not kosher to do.
See the expansion. I mean, in some sense, you assume that
I don't assume that, but I can.
But don't you need to assume that all your field theories and in terms of space time and all these things would define and actually still valid?
What I'm saying is that unless you assume that the standard field theories are correct, there's a problem.
Or that they're. Right.
I don't understand that, Robert. Why can't you just say that hatched region is a zone of ignorance?
It is a zone of ignorance. That's what I was going to say. That's a zone of ignorance here too.
And you just, but all you have to do is start your story to the right of that region.
Where do you want to start?
In a regime that's below the Planck scale.
Okay, so you will start in this. Okay, Now, there are some people who say, let's just start here at the Hubble radius. There's completely no justification for doing that.
No, no, I want to go to a shorter scale than the Hubble length, so I just use the adiabatic vacuum, as you know well, and just start the story there. I just say, whatever the physics in the Hubble region was, it delivered
the... So now I can construct quantum models of Planck scale physics, where you have highly non-adiabatic evolution here.
Yes, you can.
Okay, that's the point that I'm making.
Okay.
In fact, that's your point. Yeah. I heard it first from you many years ago. I want to give credit. This is a form of inflation which actually Ted spoke about more than 20 years ago.
Okay.
I heard you speak about it. Okay.
But the most conservative assumption is that those toy models don't reflect reality, and the story is very simple, and you just get the vacuum.
That's right. That's right. That's possible.
Okay.
But I have to make a lot of assumptions to get that story.
Okay, good.
Okay, now the only point that I want to make here is that in a bouncing cosmology, for scales that we are interested in, we are never close to this trans-Planckian regime. We also have this zone of ignorance here. So there's a reason why this might be preferable for this in terms of drawing perturbation. Obviously, I'm playing devil's advocate now, so you shouldn't take this seriously. That's just propaganda. But now I'll show you.
That 1 millimeter, that was for centimeter skin, so why should the bounce happen at centimeter skin?
Well, you give me your scale, and then I can rescale this 1 millimeter. It's just an example.
But it could be that it's not a smaller scale. If it's centimeter skin,
it won't be much smaller. It will still be. Even if you take the bounce to a 10 to the 19 GeV, this scale is still far.
Is it in your
Also, regarding these kind of bouncing, there is a violation of dominant conditions. That means that there is an instabilities.
So now we get to see that was the no, that I mean, was now we get back to the two morning talks. So you see, you might worry about the fact that if you just imagine that this behavior came from pure gravity, Einstein gravity plus matter, you could only get that if you have an instability. So that would be part three of the talk. But I don't think I will, since I will stick to linear theory, I probably won't satisfy you. Okay.
And your background. That will depend on your background.
Yes, but the background, that's what I want. Okay, so now I will make a couple of claims. Claim one. So I'll be considering a universe in which at early times the universe is dominated by matter. So this is the mirror inverse of what we see the universe today. So I'm just going to assume that at times where relevant scales are exiting the Hubble radius, the universe is matter dominated. It's a very mild assumption. So matter dominated. So for the calculation, it's not important what dominates the equation of state here, but it's important that scales that I'm interested in exit the Hubble radius in a matter-dominated phase. So I will change the title. I will add to the title, bouncing universe. I'll be more specific, matter bounce. And all I mean by matter bounce is I assume that the initial state contains a lot of non-relativistic matter, the same amount as we would as we see today.
Now in the bounce scenario, right, you are assuming the limits of gravity, Lipschitz gravity, and then K should have a different, I don't know if this linear part, does it still hold? I mean, you have a non-linear dispersion, right?
Yes.
Now if I'm just comparing how K evolves here on both sides, it has exactly the same slope. Shouldn't there also be a modification to that? Do I get something wrong?
Okay, I'm going to address it. Okay, so the way this proceeds is the following. In here, I will first do the calculation of the evolution of fluctuations, assuming that the fluctuations can be described by Einstein gravity. Then I'll study the modifications of the theory of cosmological fluctuations, and then you can check that the calculations done using using Einstein gravity for the fluctuations only get negligible fluctuations or corrections if we are interested in scales which are 1 millimeter. So that's the way we proceed. So the claim is that if you start with vacuum fluctuations, in the contracting phase, that then you will evolve to a scale invariant spectrum. After the bounce, scale invariant spectrum of curvature fluctuations. That's what inflation predicts. So this claim shows that the matter bounce can provide an alternative to inflation for generating the kind of perturbations that we have evidence for. Now, the second claim is that this matter bounce can be distinguished from inflation, and that you have specific predictions and the specific prediction is order one amplitude and a specific shape of the three-point function of curvature fluctuations, the bispectrum. So you see, any alternative to inflation has to make predictions with which it can be distinguished. And the claim here is that if you calculate the three-point function, then you do get specific predictions. And this amplitude is in the ballpark of what can be reached by the Planck satellite, specifically. Wait for a moment, because you see, first of all, FNL is not well defined. You asked what is the number FNL. The three-point function has a lot of shape information. So I can't answer your question right now. First, you have to wait a while. But I'll give you an answer in a while. OK.
Sorry, for somebody that doesn't know cosmology, what is the three-point function in the usual inflationary story?
It is very small. No, it's not zero, because the equations are nonlinear. They're nonlinear. The linearities in the gravitational stuff.
OK, but it's purely controlled by those nonlinearities.
Right, and it's suppressed by the slow roll product of inflation to some power. It's typically very, very small.
Okay.
It also.
So this is, you're predicting a huge difference in the strength of that correlation.
Yes, but you know that there's a huge variety of inflationary models with one field, two fields, curvatons, all that. And you can certainly generate inflationary models which have a large amplitude. The specific shape is a prediction. But we actually have numbers, you see, for in each shape direction, we give a number. And so it will be very, very difficult to construct an inflationary number, an inflationary model which would predict, which would agree with all of those numbers. Okay. Good, so the framework so what we do is we look at the metric that includes cosmological perturbations. And I will use the usual symbols. So this capital phi, that's a function of space and time, beta is conformal time. This is just the three spatial metric. I've assumed here to be flat. Okay, so now the variable which cosmologists are interested in is a particular curvature fluctuation, which is defined as scale factor divided by yeah. Okay, this.
That's true.
So again, these corrections, you see, the equations become much more complicated, but trust me that we've actually done that part of the calculation. correctly. Okay. Okay. So now to simplify the algebra, we take matter to be a scalar field. For example, a scalar field which is oscillating in a quadratic potential. That gives us a matter equation of state. And this is the fluctuation of that scalar field. This is this metric. This variable is the curvature perturbation that cosmologists are interested in. So, and Z is a function of the background, which is scale factor times background matter divided by H. And prime is d by d eta, and H is a prime over A. And if the equation of state of the background doesn't change, the Z is proportional to A. So that's the curvature fluctuation. And then there's a variable, which is Z times zeta. This is the variable in terms of which the quadratic action for fluctuations has canonical form. So this is the canonical fluctuation variable, which is also called the Sasaki-Mukhanov variable. So this is the variable used for calculations. This is the variable we want to compute.
What is the background? If it's not changed, then time should be 0 and then Z is proportional to 0. Why is this equal to 1? If I notice the background, if it doesn't change, the derivative.
You've caught a very important point. At the turning point of oscillations, there's a singularity in the equations. That's the singularity in the gauge in which zeta is the curvature fluctuation of. Again, that's something that happens in inflation as well during inflationary reheating. Because in inflationary reheating, you deal with these variables. In inflationary reheating, the scalar field is oscillating. There are points in time where phi naught prime vanishes. There are the same kind of singularities in the equation, but it's not a singularity in the solution. It's an integral singularity. It's no problem. I can give you the reference. Bobby Finelli and myself, 1999.
I ask you a stupid question. I'm not clear how you include these sort of scaling in your equation.
Right. See, this will come over here. What I'm doing now is I'm saying we are looking at wavelengths which are 1 millimeter scale, even at the bounds. And so therefore, it should be a very good approximation to neglect these high derivative terms coming from the anisotropic scaling. And then, after we establish the formalism to treat them, we can come back and show that that's self-sufficient. But that's all only at linear level. Linear.
I would have thought you should have also used that in the
Right. Okay, but you see, the message that I'm trying to give you is, here, everything here will be true for any bounds in cosmology, even if it arises from something very different than Hodge revolutions. But in any theory that gives you a bounds, you'll have correction terms to the usual Einstein equations. So then in any theory that gives you a bounds, you'll have to look at the equation of multiple fluctuations, including the exit terms, and then see what the effect of those terms are. Are you?
I was just wondering whether you can just doing a gauge transformation and you can see.
No, this is not a gauge transformation. What I'm doing is I'm neglecting terms which indicate the motion, which are k over m Planck to some power which is at least 2.
Okay.
So it amounts to neglecting these terms in equation of motion for fluctuations.
Sorry, you're also neglecting something very important, which is
the extra degree of freedom.
The extra degree of freedom.
The extra degree of freedom does not arise at the new order. Yeah.
Of course, yeah, but
yeah. That's why I was stressing that everything I say.
I agree, but then you should see, okay, at which level does this degree of freedom enter, and it may be problematic.
Yeah, right. It's important to mention. Okay. Good. So now, Again, for people who are not working in cosmology, I'll write down the quantity which we are told to compute. And this is the power spectrum of the curvature fluctuation. And the power spectrum of a quantity zeta is defined as k cubed zeta of k squared. So we work in momentum space, but this is a position space quantity. The mean of this quantity is you take a sphere of radius k inverse, and this power spectrum gives you the root mean square fluctuation of this position space quantity. That's the power spectrum that we need to compute. Okay? And scaling variant is proportional to k to the power 0. This is scaling variant. Okay. So now, what happens for a vacuum spectrum? If you look at claim one up there, which we start in the contracting phase with a vacuum spectrum. And the vacuum spectrum means that each of these harmonic oscillator modes starts out in its quantum mechanical ground state, which means that p zeta of k is k cubed, well, k to the minus 1/2 square. That's the vacuum spectrum, k squared. We have a preferred time, which is, so it's a state which is empty of particles in this preferred frame, as measured by an Ungerleider detector.
When you're talking about these millimeter wavelengths now, right? Yep. And the Hubble length at that time is?
Much larger.
Much larger. So this is the point. It's a locally defined vacuum.
Okay. So now, in order to get a scaling variant spectrum from a vacuum spectrum, you need something that boosts long wavelength modes relative to short wavelength modes. Okay. So long wavelength modes have to be boosted compared to short wavelength modes. Now, the fact about cosmological perturbations is probably the most important fact is that there's an asymmetry between the expanding phase and the contracting phase. In the expanding phase, so first of all, I'll write down this equation of motion for the canonical variable. I think this is the key equation I will be using. So this canonical fluctuation variable, V, satisfies this equation of motion. And Z is H, sorry, Z is A, scale factor. So this is of the order h squared. So this equation says that on wavelengths smaller than the Hubble radius, fluctuations oscillate, whereas on wavelengths larger than the Hubble radius, vk goes in an expanding universe proportional to z. That's a squeezing of fluctuations. So in the expanding phase, you get vk proportional to z, which means fluctuations become squeezed, they become classical, but the amplitude of the curvature perturbation is constant because zeta is z inverse v. Now, in a contracting universe, matter bounds, you have vk proportional to z to the minus 1/2. That's the dominant mode. This mode exists as well, but this mode is the subdominant mode. In the contracting phase, the dominant mode vk grows, which means zk goes as z to the minus 3/2 growth. So fluctuations grow on super Hubble scale in the contracting phase. And long wavelengths experience the growth longer than short wavelength modes. And so therefore, this you have the preferential boost of long wavelength modes compared to short wavelength modes, which can turn the vacuum spectrum into a scale invariant spectrum. Now you have to trust.
Andrew, as an inflation, right?
No, in inflation, there's only the expanding bunch. So this is what happens in inflation.
Right.
In inflation, you start out scale invariant when you exit the Hubble radius. Theta is constant.
Right.
Here, in a contracting universe, you have this phase of contraction during which theta is growing. You get the preferential growth of long wavelength nodes, which can turn a vacuum spectrum into a scale invariant spectrum. This is again first but derived from gate ones. I'm getting myself getting late 90s.
I didn't please.
Sorry. What is your vacuum?
No, the vacuum is the Minkowski. See, I'm dealing with wavelengths smaller than the Hubble radius. So standard Minkowski vacuum, the way that I would phrase it, it's the state which is empty of classical particles in the preferential frame.
So I guess are you saying that once the contracting phase is finished, you've then got a spectrum that's the same as you would have had?
Yeah. So here at this point, you have a scale invariant spectrum of fluctuations on super bubble scales.
Okay.
Then you can calculate how the fluctuations cross the non-singular region. Mm-hmm. So no singularities in the equation, you find that it's resolved.
Okay, now, did you tell us? I might have missed it. Why is it that you get a scale invariant spectrum? I see that the longer wavelengths are more boosted, but why scale invariant?
Okay, that comes from having exactly the matter dominated phase. If you had any equation state which were not matter dominated, you either get too much boosting or not enough boosting. So it's a special property of the matter dominated phase of contraction. And there you have to accept my algebra now. I don't have time to show you the algebra.
So is that matter-dominated phase input to the problem?
Or? Yes, that's input. But again, so I'm assuming that in the mirror image, time image, that at this stage, where scales that we observe today are exiting the Hubble rate, that universe is matter-dominated. That's input. That's very mild input.
But not for the entire contracting phase.
It doesn't need to be. It only needs to be...
Is that because the lion's share of the effect comes from the longest time, which is the matter-dominated part?
No, at any time after exit on scales larger than the smallest mode that's exited, you have a scale invariant spectrum. But that, at that level, please let me go on now. That's too much detail. But I'd be happy to show you.
Could you repeat it again? Suppose it was the history was just the reverse of the cosmological history. You have matter domination.
That's what I had. Yeah.
To a certain point, and then radiation takes over,
right.
Then you get the balance. Is that okay?
That's right. Yeah.
That's okay.
And then the statement is that on all scales that exit the Hubble radius during the matter dominated contracting phase, I have a scale invariant spectrum. If I go to very small scales, which exited in the radiation spectrum, then there are deviations from scale invariants.
So in this sense, the mechanism is independent of how many higher order terms you have in the action, as long as it gives you...
As long as
you
get a bounce.
Right.
Yep.
So, can I ask,
since I'm in charge, I don't know. that's the normal GR equation. So,
yeah.
So I agree with you. The normal thing, even in GR, you have mass, you can generate scalar rent and collapse. And so it's obvious that works. But is that what you actually get when you perturb...
Yes.
Okay. It's exactly the same as GR.
The exotermes are suppressed by K over M Planck to some kind.
So the only change is the Freeman equations get changed, mm-hmm. The perturbation equations the same.
Right.
So the role of Fourier gravity is to actually get the bounce.
Right.
After that, the story is in
right. Right. So my message to people who are on string theory, for example, and who might not particularly like contravolitional gravity is, don't try to force inflation into string theory. Because it seems very difficult to do that. People have been trying for a long, long time. But there might be much more natural ways to get a bouncing cosmology from string theory. And in a couple of weeks, there'll be a paper in which Rackley presents a very nice model.
Robert, can I ask you? I think a very simpler question. So way down at the bottom of that middle board, the universe is matter dominated, but it's completely uniform matter. Yes. The metric is completely uniform, except for these vacuum fluctuations. Yes. And that's what we're talking about over here? The vacuum fluctuations above this?
Right.
Okay.
Okay. So now, in light of the time, I cannot discuss this distinctive signature, which is the non-Gaussianity. So I will not be able to answer your question about the FNL. I have to leave it with the clay here. Okay.
How much time would you need?
we can reverse it. I can come back to this afterwards because I want to talk about the more controversial thing. I want to mention why do I say matter dance and not cyclic scenario? That might be questions a lot of you are interested in because a lot of you have worked on the, or some of you have worked on the ekphorotic scenario. Okay. So this is our decide. What about cyclic matter dance? Question mark. That was subsection D, subsection C. I skipped. That was the FNL. Okay. So now what we want is we want to have a space-time diagram in which there's an expanding phase, the bounds. But previously, there was another cycle. So contracting, bounce, expansion, re-collapse, another bounce. So that would be part of the cyclic evolution. So now the message I want to tell you is that this scenario cannot be cyclic. Even if you propose a cyclic background model, the fluctuations will break the cyclicity. And let's see how that happens. We start with a vacuum spectrum, which is n equals 1. So usually power spectrum, k to the n minus 1. Scale invariant is n equals 1. Now, I've shown you that after the bounce, you get n equals plus 1. Vacuum spectrum was n equals 3. So that's the vacuum spectrum, n equals 3. After the bounce, you get n equals 1. Well, fluctuations don't change inside the Hubble radius. So therefore, in the next contracting phase, you don't have a vacuum spectrum, but n equals 1. And so here you'll have n equals minus 1. There's a processing of fluctuations in a bouncing cosmology, which means that in a four-dimensional setting, even if you give a cyclic background, the model is not cyclic. Even assuming that there's no entropy production. What could go wrong is you could have entropy production in each bounce too.
Does it matter where you start in this logic?
No, it doesn't. I'm just showing you that it's only this one bounce scenario that I can turn a vacuum spectrum into a scale invariant spectrum.
But
after the second bounce,
I think I now know why Rob asked his question. I mean, it's a tuning to put it as the vacuum in the initial state. In the usual story of inflation, the beauty is that the state just evolves to the vacuum, whatever
it was. Modulo the transformation problem.
Yeah, but it's a very broad class of evolutions. In your case, presumably you have to do a super fine tuning to the vacuum in the initial state.
From the point of view of the cyclic cosmology, absolutely. So, now, does that mean that the ekphorotic cyclic scenario does not work? The answer there is no. Because in the ekphorotic scenario, the scale factor of all four dimensions is expanding continuously, monotonically. The only thing that's cycling is the separation of the two brains. So the ekparotic cyclic scenario does not suffer from this non-cyclic evolution of fluctuation, because each cycle in the ekparotic scenario is exploring different range of wavelengths. But this is the reason why I'm only interested in a one bounce scenario. And again, you're absolutely right about this tuning of initial conditions. Okay. Good.
Okay, so now
let me come to the actual cosmological perturbation, linear cosmological perturbation.
The n equals minus 5. So it's a very infrared, very red spectrum. That's right.
Which one?
N equal to minus 1. So if you go to very short wavelengths, you still have vacuum.
Yes.
So it may be that you get the same picture but on a smaller and smaller scale.
But again, that's not. It doesn't mean that the evolution is still not cyclic.
But it's cyclic up to Majudai and Ries.
We have a fixed measuring stick. So.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay. Good. So now, comes the following claim. And the claim is that a linear cosmological perturbation theory
there is no extra degree of freedom. So I want to get across why this is true. So the formalism we have, so I'll consider scalar metric fluctuations, and in this case, there are four free functions, phi of x and t, b of x and t, psi of x and t, e of x and t. And then I have the matter fluctuation. Okay, so we have 5 degrees of freedom.
Perturbations around a bouncing cosmology?
Around an expanded cosmology, and then ask the question about bouncing cosmology in a couple of minutes. That's the in preparation part.
This is around any, as I said this morning, around any
homogeneous and isotropic.
Yeah.
So now, in general relativity, you start with 5 degrees of freedom. And then you have space-dependent time parameterizations and spatial diffeomorphisms preserving the scalar character. You have 2 gauge degrees of freedom.
So these 2 gauge degrees of freedom is xi goes to xi plus f, i, and x0 of t goes to t plus f naught of x and t. 2 gauge degrees of freedom. Okay. So then you have for matter, like a scalar field, you have no anisotropic stress. And then finally, you have an energy constraint. You can't have any matter perturbations without metric perturbations. And that leaves you with 1 degree of freedom. That's the usual degree of freedom that one has for linear cosmological perturbations in Einstein gravity.
Yes, now if you add a complicated matter sector, then you can have entropy modes. So now what happens if, we start with the same number of degrees of freedom, but we lose this. So we have 1 gauge degree of freedom. We have 1 no anisotropic stress. You have the energy constraint. But then it turns out that the momentum constraint provides information, exactly the required information that the loss of this makes up for. You get 1 degree. So this is the way to understand the results of our calculation. This is not our calculation. So now, I only have time to sketch what we've done, to tell you the steps.
Hey, Robert, sorry, what's the momentum constraint and why is it not present in the GR?
Because you've eliminated the variable which enters in the momentum constraint by the gauge degree of freedom. I will mention that. Just maybe wait a minute. So, first of all, the step 1 in the analysis is we choose a gauge. E equals 0. My variable up there. But I can't choose B equals 0, which one usually would choose. The time reprioritization would usually allow us to choose B equals 0. So now step 2 is we insert into the constraint equations, and that gives us phi equals and B equals. Momentum constraint tells us B equals that. Now, in general relativity, we already know that B is 0. So this is the equation which in general relativity it's given by the momentum constraint. It's an empty equation, yet it's no longer empty. And let me just illustrate what the result looks like. H is the expansion rate of the background. Just look at the denominator. Some function of psi. So now, if you were to have done this analysis inconsistently about h equals 0, you would find a strong coupling singularity at lambda equals 1, and you would have a ghost sign. If you do it consistently, in a cosmological background, you find no ghost and no strong coupling instability. And here, it is similar. That's step 2. Now in step 3, what we do is we insert these expressions into the action for fluctuations, which is a quadratic action. And then we find that S2, the quadratic action for fluctuations in terms of the remaining variables, delta phi, takes on a very interesting form if we express it not in terms of these two variables, but in terms of the variable zeta, which is a canonical variable in general relativity,
and Sarah. And the statement is, and I just want to say that in words, that the action for these two variables contains no kinetic term for psi, only kinetic term for zeta. Psi has no kinetic piece. So that's the decoupling of this mode at the level of linear perturbation theory. So that is the steps that we use to verify this claim. And if we look at one final equation, which I want to write down. If we take the action S2 theta psi, we look at as a coefficient of the variable which has a kinetic term, and this coefficient C zeta is only look at the denominator. Numerator is not important. Okay, lambda minus one, phi naught dot square minus I. If we would inconsistently have set h equals 0, we would have a strong coupling instability at lambda equals 0 and a ghost. If we consistently take the Friedmann background equations, which tells us that this term is larger than this term, we basically get no ghost, no strong coupling instability. Okay, so this is what I wanted to tell you. Now, obviously, I left out one section, which was the section about the non-Gaussianities, the three-point function in the matter bounds. But I don't want to. I think discussion is more important. No, this is kappa.
That's kappa. Okay, great.
So you say if I do perturbations around flat space, I'll get some nonsense. So the only setting in which this makes sense is a cosmological setting.
Or CMCs that are constant mean temperatures.
Now, I do need help from the audience, though. If anyone in the audience has a tissue, I would be appreciating, because there are some technical problems in giving Blackboard talks. You haven't encountered yet.
Yeah.
Make a comment on what Shumit was just saying. This is all very seemingly consistent with, again, the phase diagram of the theory, which really says that in some regime, once you flow from the practical fixed point into a regime which hopefully plus is equal to 1, you might be in the spatially modulated phase where clearly the flat space, the homogeneous solution is not going to be the ground state, and you will see instabilities. They just tell you that there might be a different solution which might be modulated, as we have seen in Planner's analysis of the planning
process.
The question is whether one can visualize a spatially modulated phase or whether the modulation should be really a mandatory time dependent, and then you would end up with a cosmological solution which is more stable in some formal sense of not exhibiting instabilities compared to the flat space.
I don't want to repeat myself because I'm playing on the time the same role. I think it's clear that maybe this problem that I emphasized many times. So with there, and also, so I think that the nonlinear. So what there is a step four that you missed. So step four is now that I know the linear theory, I see that the nonlinear effects are small. Okay, and also the strong coupling is the thing with the strong coupling is that now it's not depending on lambda but on the. So there is always a strong coupling effect. But now it's not in the limit lambda going to 1, but h going to 0. So it's true that. So the theory is going to be strongly coupled.
That's a parameter of the solution.
Yeah, but still, I mean, neither the solution. It's a little phenomenological constraint.
That's similar to this comment of trying to find an order parameter which is constant in the wrong phase.
But how large does H have to be? What's the, there's a phi naught dot, is that right, squared?
You see, those are related by the background fringe.
Oh, so it's always going to be...
Yeah.
This is...
Sorry, I just wanted to make a comment that the scale in Manipara spectrum actually continues into various power scales, as far as we can see. So if you cannot have a mirror reflection of expanding phase in the contracting phase, because you want the matter dominant mirror to be longer actually in the contracting phase.
That's fine. So with a little bit of entropy for the production of the bounce will make that. We'll solve that one for you. Yeah, you don't need that much.
If you just look at a nearly flat region of our universe, then this expansion is clearly not relevant. Is it going to be enough if I just use the curvature of the sun's gravitational field to make all local perturbations stable?
Okay, that question I don't know the answer. That's a crucial question.
Indeed. If you put a background, the background is going to be...
You're saying now, what we really should do, we should also study what happens with perturbations by torsion.
For instance.
Yeah. And that's much more difficult than studying cosmological perturbations, which is why I didn't have the intention to do it.
This is very similar to what happens in massive gravity. For those in the audience interested. In massive gravity, you can also, when you have strong coupling problems, when you have instability problems, if you try that around generic backgrounds, the backgrounds may indeed make the new divisor field well behave. Right? But you still have to do it for September.
Okay, so let's thank Robert.